Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former U.S. Ambassador Edward Peck, who was on board one of the boats in the Gaza aid flotilla attacked by Israel, and discusses why he took part in the challenge of the Gaza blockade and what critics charge was Israel's disproportionate response. Palestinian farmer Daoud Nassar, who talks about his struggle to prevent the Israeli government from taking over his family's land near the West Bank town of Bethlehem. And Jonathan Manis of the ACLU's National Security Project, who explains why his group is challenging the legality and oversight of America's use of unmanned drone attacks for targeted assassinations of terrorist suspects. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The ongoing BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is a daily outrage as oil and gas continues to foul the water, beaches, and wetlands. But in the oil-rich Niger Delta in West Africa, out-of-control oil leaks caused by rusting oil infrastructure are barely noticed. According to a study by the World Wildlife Federation and the World Conservation Union, over 1.5 million tons of crude oil have been spilled in the Niger Delta since the early 1970s, 50 times more than were spilled in the Exxon Valdez incident in Alaska in 1989. In early May, a ruptured ExxonMobil pipeline in Ikwa Ibom, Nigeria, spilled 1 million gallons of oil per day for a week before it was stopped. According to the Guardian newspaper, community leaders in the spill area are now seeking $1 billion in compensation for illnesses and lost income. Over the years, there have been over 2,000 major oil spills in the Niger Delta. Currently, Nigeria accounts for 40% of all U.S. oil imports and is the world's leader in oil pollution. Life expectancy in many rural areas with oil-polluted water has fallen to less than 40 years of age since the oil boom started in the early 1970s. Apple CEO Steve Jobs was put on the defensive at the recent high-profile All Things Digital conference in California. Jobs had to defend his key Chinese contract manufacturer, Foxconn, the maker of the iPad and iPhone, which has suffered from a rash of worker suicides in recent weeks. Jobs insisted the massive factory complex, which employs over 300,000 workers, is not a sweatshop. Jobs noted, "The suicides are a difficult situation that we're trying to understand right now before we go in and say we know the solution." So far this year, 10 young workers have committed suicide at the Foxconn complex in Shenzhen, China. Most of the deaths have been blamed on long hours and stressful working conditions. In response to the suicides, Foxconn has raised workers' pay to as much as $300 per month, double their recent salaries. Taiwan-based Foxconn, also known as Hanhai, is a major contractor for tech companies like Apple, Sony, Dell, and Hewlett-Packard. Businessweek attributes the company's massive revenues to its practice of offering its products to Western high-tech firms at extremely low prices. But the string of worker suicides has sent up warning flags for big American technology companies concerned about their corporate image. In a dramatic shift in recent months, corporate political action committees, or PACs, have shifted away from giving campaign contributions to Democrats. Key industries like healthcare and pharmaceuticals are donating heavily to GOP candidates. Corporate America is gambling that Republicans will take over Congress in this fall's midterm election. According to the Washington Post, this is the biggest shift in corporate political giving since 1995, after Newt Gingrich and the Republicans took over the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. During the healthcare debate in Congress, House Republicans were the top recipients of political donations from the healthcare and pharmaceutical lobbies. The biggest fundraising winner was David Camp, the ranking GOP member of the House Ways and Means Committee. In the first quarter of this year, his PAC funds have increased by 100%. In 2009, 55% of drug giant Pfizer's giving went to Democrats, but in the first 3 months of 2010, over 60% of its political contributions went to Republicans. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
less than a week after Israel launched a military assault on a flotilla of six civilian ships carrying humanitarian aid to Palestinians living in Gaza, which resulted in the deaths of nine passengers, the Israeli Navy intercepted another cargo ship challenging its three-year-old blockade of Gaza. The ship of Irish registry, the Rachel Corrie, was named after a U.S. activist killed by an Israeli bulldozer when she attempted to prevent the destruction of a Palestinian home in 2003. The vessel was boarded without reports of violence and brought to the Israeli port of Ashdod. Israel said the humanitarian aid on board the 1,200-ton cargo ship would be inspected and items not banned would be transported by truck to Gaza. Among the passengers on board the Rachel Corrie were Irish citizens Mairead Maguire, who won a Nobel Peace Prize for her advocacy of a peaceful settlement in Northern Ireland, and Dennis Halliday, a former UN humanitarian aid coordinator in Iraq, who resigned in protest over the imposition of economic sanctions on Iraqi civilians. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is now attempting to convene an international body to investigate Israel's May 31st assault on the six aid ships and the circumstances surrounding the deaths of nine passengers on the largest ship, the Mavi Marmara. Former U.S. Ambassador to Mauritania, Edward Peck, was among those on board the Greek-flagged boat Sfidoni, one of the other five ships intercepted by the Israelis. Peck is a 32-year veteran of the U.S. Foreign Service, who was President Reagan's deputy director of the White House Task Force on Terrorism. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ambassador Peck about why he participated in the aid flotilla, accusations by Israel that the passengers on the aid ships had links to terrorists, and the reasons behind the growing international movement challenging Israel's Gaza blockade.
The whole flotilla was a European organized thing, as you may have noted. There were some 30-plus organizations from 30-plus countries that put this thing together. And at the last minute, they said we should have an American group. So they contacted an organization based in the San Francisco Bay Area called the Free Palestine Movement. And they said, okay, we can get a couple of slots for your people. And they called me, and I had never had any dealings with those interesting people before. And they said, would you like to go? Would you will be willing to go? And I thought about it, and I said, okay, all these years I've been talking about the Middle East and meeting people and bringing people together and explaining and listening, and maybe it's time to do something of a little more concrete nature. And that's why I went. My objective, you know, I could certainly not stand up and say what anybody else was thinking about. My objective was twofold. One was, of course, to get the humanitarian goods into that savagely attacked and partially destroyed area, which was suffering a really severe blockade on land and sea, which I thought would be a nice humanitarian act. And secondly, a certain amount of naivety here, and I'll admit it even after all these years, I thought that here's a chance for Israel to say, okay, come in with that material. You people stay out because they don't need people there in Gaza drinking their water and eating their food, and come across as a bunch of good guys. And I was savagely mistaken on the second part because our friend Israel prefers to use the mailed fist and the heavy hammer in efforts to advance its foreign policies in the region, and that's what they did. My principal reaction, seriously, when I opened my eyes and here are these guys already on board our boat because all they had to do is to step from the deck of theirs to the deck of ours, that's a small little 30-meter boat, was disappointment. Oh, my. Never dreaming that on the bigger one, the people would try to defend their ship and wind up getting killed.
On the ship you were in, I had read accounts that people tried to keep the Israeli commandos that boarded the ship out of the wheelhouse to prevent them from commandeering the boat and bringing it to the Israeli port of Ashdod.
Right. I was on the second deck down. There are three decks on that ship, really. I was in the middle deck, and it was all over because they just walked in the door, and there they were on the upper deck where the wheelhouse is. The people tried to offer what is called passive resistance, where you lock arms and get in the way. And the Israeli commandos didn't like that, so they broke some windows and used some stun grenades, and they hurt a bunch of people getting them out of there, so that when the ship finally docked in Ashdod, the first group of people to get off were the injured. One on crutches, several with their arms in slings, one man with a neck brace, bandages on the head, this sort of thing, plus other wounds that you couldn't see. Nothing serious, but they got pretty badly roughed up. The little group that I was with, we just sat there and stared at the gun muzzles.
Ambassador Peck, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in reaction to worldwide protests against the Israeli assault on these aid vessels, has claimed that some of the passengers aboard the aid flotilla and the Mavi Marmara, the ship where the violent clashes took place and the nine passengers were killed. Netanyahu says that some of these passengers had links to terrorists. How do you react to that?
Well, you know, I have to ask this question. What is it that we expected Mr. Netanyahu to say, that the boat was filled with tree-hugging pacifists? You know, it's called, in American politics, that's called smearing the opposition, you know. But were there some people like that? I don't know. But the intent, there were no weapons on the ship. That's why they had to use, you know, ship's rails that they tore loose and a couple of deck chairs, as I recall. But of course he said that. It would be similar to us saying, on this side of the issue, that those commandos can only be assigned to the Union if they're committed rapists or child molesters. Now, there may be some people in the commandos who fit that description. I have no idea. But once you do that, you change the whole level of the dialogue into, yes, I did, no, I didn't.
Ambassador Peck, it seems that the Israelis, in terms of world opinion, have suffered a lot of ill will, given that they're accused widely of disproportionate responses to the threats they confront. And we can look at everything from the death of Rachel Corrie, an American activist who sat down in front of a bulldozer and was killed in a military operation to destroy a Palestinian home, to the 2006 Lebanese invasion, to the recent invasion of Gaza, to this military operation on the ships that you were on. It seems that there's a psychology at work in Israel that they have to be as tough or brutal as possible. From a political perspective, that just doesn't seem to make sense in terms of their long-term welfare as a state.
Well, I would certainly agree with you, but you know, one of the things that's interesting is that Israel has always said, both the civilians and the army, that if you provoke us, our response is going to be disproportional. And certainly that has been the case in so many instances in which there seems to be the belief that you, to which you refer and which I recognize, that if we really savagely respond, they won't do it again. Well, that doesn't work in a situation in which people are motivated by belief that they have been mistreated or, you know, have had bad things, unacceptable things happen to them. That generates more. And I find this so unfortunate because in my own case, you know, and I stress this, I don't want anything bad to happen to one Israeli, but I am very much afraid that what is going on is going to hurt Israelis and Americans, and it already has.
That was former U.S. Ambassador to Mauritania Edward Peck, who was among those on board the Greek-flagged boat Sfidoni, one of six ships intercepted by the Israeli military on May 31st. For more information on the Free Gaza Movement, one of the groups coordinating the Gaza aid ships, visit their website at freegaza.org. Daoud Nassar lives with his family on 100 acres on a hilltop outside Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank of Palestine. Although he has documentation dating back to the Ottoman Empire that his family owns the land, the State of Israel has been trying to claim it for 20 years, leading to a long, expensive legal battle. Because the Israelis have forbidden the construction of any new buildings on his property, Nassar founded a group called Tent of Nations and set up several large tents to house Israeli, Palestinian, and international volunteers who come to tend the land and be a focus of nonviolent resistance to Israeli occupation. With the financial support of a group of Americans, Nassar travels to the U.S. twice a year to speak around the country about his struggle to keep his family's land. The following excerpt of Nassar's talk was recorded on May 3rd at St. Patrick's St. Anthony Catholic Church in Hartford, Connecticut.
In 1991, we heard by chance that Israel declared our farm as a state land. Declaring it as a state land means that the land has no owner. We have the papers, but we went to the court, to the military court, and our lawyer presented the title for the land. Of course, it was not expected by the Israelis to have papers, so the case was postponed. But because of our location in the middle of a ring of Israeli settlements, they started to make it difficult for us to prove ownership. They said, well, we need to check out if your papers are for the right place. So we had to survey the land again. We had to bring eyewitnesses. We had to survey the land 7 times so far. And the legal battle started in 1991 and it is going on until today with a financial burden of $150,000. Of course, this is very difficult for us, but we thought we need to prove our ownership. We need to do it. On the ground, we are facing many difficulties like roadblocks. So we are our farm is being now disconnected from Bethlehem area. The other thing we are facing is the harassment of the Israeli settlers who came to uproot trees. They were threatening us with guns. They damaged our water tank. And they tried a couple of times to build a settlement on our land. Even the case was still in court and still in court. They are trying to put, you know, physical pressure on us in order to give up and leave. And they tried 3 times to build a road in order to establish a settlement. And the last, it was in 1997, 1998, 1999. And then in 2002, they came with big machines. They started working on our farm. We were not able to cross or to be near the settlers because we were scared that they will shoot at us. 3 days later, we managed to stop that road by court from the Supreme Court in Israel. And the settlers were very angry and they uprooted 250 olive trees from our property. It was very difficult for us, very difficult situation because we had the feeling we are alone in this struggle. But 3 weeks later, we received an email from a Jewish organization from England called European Jews for Just Peace in Palestine, and they sponsored 250 olive trees. They came and planted also these trees. It was a sign of hope. A sign of solidarity. Now we are still facing difficulties on the farm in terms of roadblocks, as I said before, and the biggest obstacle is the war. And this situation is bringing the Palestinians whether to react in a violent way or be passive and do nothing or migrate and leaving the country. These are the 3 options that we see ourselves as Palestinians facing. Some people, they say, well, with violence we can achieve victory. Some people, they say, well, we have to wait for a superpower to come and for protection, for salvation. And some other people, among them are the best educated people and also Christians, they believe that there is no hope in that area. So why to bother ourselves and stay there? Why not to find another possibility to go outside and live there? We had a camp with teenagers, Palestinian children, last summer, and I asked the children, what are you planning to do after you finish school? They said, all of them, without any exception, 25 young people, they said, if we have an opportunity to leave, we will be leaving the country. For us, we said, we will never leave the area. We will never be passive people and sit down and cry and be the victims. And we said, we will never react in a violent way. We will resist in a non-violent way. And that's why we created a 4th option for us, which is called We Refuse to be Enemies. And it is not easy to say this word, you know, because we are living in a situation where only we see the enemies. I know the Israelis as soldiers and radical settlers. They know us as radical Palestinians. Why? Because we are separated from each other. We don't know each other as faces. We don't know that among Israelis and Palestinians there are people who believe in justice, who believe in living together, and we believe in coexistence. And the idea is we want to resist the evil not with evil. We want to resist the evil with good. And of course this is a Christian way of non-violent resistance. So we created the Tent of Nations on our farm, and the idea, we said, we are not the victims. We are able to do something positive even the situation is very hard.
That was Daoud Nassar of the group Tent of Nations. Since this talk, threats have escalated when on May 27th, Israeli officials ordered the demolition of 9 structures built without a government permit during the last 2 years. Nassar is now taking his fight to save his land to the Israeli Supreme Court. For more information, visit the website tentofnations.org or contact their American support group, Friends of Tent of Nations North America, at area code 301-320-0049, or through their website, fotonna.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. During his first 18 months in office, President Obama has increased the use of unmanned drone attacks on suspected terrorists in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and other nations. The increase in the use of Predator drones is a strategy reportedly advocated by Vice President Joe Biden, but which has caused friction between Washington and both the Afghan and Pakistani governments. Supporters of the use of drones boast that these weapons have enabled the U.S. military and CIA to kill 34 out of the top 42 al-Qaeda operatives in Iraq. U.S. officials have also recently claimed that a drone attack killed Mustafa Abu al-Yazid, al-Qaeda's third-ranking operative in Pakistan. But in a report made to the United Nations Human Rights Council on June 3rd, Philip Alston, the U.N.'s Special Representative on Extrajudicial Executions, called on the U.S. to use greater restraint in using unmanned drones to commit targeted assassinations of terrorism suspects beyond the war zones in Afghanistan. There is growing concern among international human rights activists and military officials that Washington's use of drones, based on a questionable legal foundation, could lead to a chaotic situation where dozens of nations carry out their own drone attacks across borders against individuals they label as terrorists. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Jonathan Manis, legal fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project. He explains why his group filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit in March to obtain the government's legal basis for drone attacks, the number of civilians killed, and the process of oversight and accountability for such attacks.
It appears that the president has authorized a program that permits the CIA to put the names of individuals on a list, a kill list, if you want to call it that, which I think would be fair. And the criteria that would get a person onto this list are unknown. They're secret. And obviously the evidence that would get a person onto the list are secret. And the entire program is operated with minimal oversight and accountability. So essentially the president's claiming the authority unilaterally to put the names of individuals, including U.S. citizens, I should say, on a list and to target them anywhere in the world that they might be found. It's hard to square that with the relevant human rights law. And in any case, if the president's going to engage in this kind of activity, it's extremely important that the public knows what its government is up to.
Jonathan, in a very public way, the Obama administration has admitted that the government has authorized an assassination by drone or other means to kill a U.S. citizen in Yemen, Anwar al-Awlaki, who is alleged to be connected to the Fort Hood shooting, as well as the failed Christmas Day underwear bomber from Nigeria and his failed attack on an airliner bound for Detroit. How do you respond to this escalation of the use of drones, not only to kill foreign terrorists, but actually U.S. citizens who may or may not be responsible for threats to this country?
Right. Well, I mean, it's extremely troubling that the program has been expanded to U.S. citizens. I mean, U.S. citizens don't lose their constitutional protections when they leave the borders of the United States. And again, U.S. citizen or not, outside of a zone where there is a war going on, where the rules that govern war properly apply, you can't kill a person unless these are standards that are familiar from the domestic context. A police officer can't kill a person unless there's a imminent threat to life and the use of lethal force is necessary to prevent that. I suppose it may be possible that the government complies with those standards, but we have no indication that they do. And it's hard to square the idea that a person's name is put on a list after a sort of bureaucratic process in a sort of secret enclave of the government and that the name stays on that list for several months at a time. And then, presumably, when the person is found, you know, the government, you know, attempts to kill the person. It's hard to see how that would comply with this imminence requirement, and also with the requirement that it be, you know, a genuine last resort. So, if for example, if al-Awlaki could be captured, the government, I think, has an obligation to pursue that alternative.
there is a concern expressed by the UN representative on extrajudicial executions, Philip Alston, that the United States policy on these unmanned drone attacks could lead to dozens of nations launching their own cross-border drone attacks against individuals and groups that they label terrorists, just as the United States does. And the concern here is that there would be untold violence and chaos sown by what the United States is now doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. So the United States is still a leader in international law. So if the United States asserts that something is acceptable, other countries will feel quite free to do the same and then point to the United States' example as justification. So it seems that the principle that's being endorsed here is that when a country considers itself to be in a conflict against an armed group that's not sort of attached to any particular state, that it can use lethal force anywhere that it believes that a suspect is to be found. So it's not crazy to think that countries that we don't consider our allies could take the view that enemies of their state are located in countries that we're friendly with, and that they're entitled to use lethal force using drones or otherwise in those countries. So there's many countries out there with very sophisticated militaries, and drones apparently are not all that a complex a technology these days. So I think there's something like, I think you said, 40 countries which have developed unmanned aerial vehicles. And these countries, I think, are rapidly developing the capability to deploy missiles on these unmanned vehicles so that they could do just what the United States is doing. So it's really troubling, the idea that rules that govern war, I mean, the rules that govern war are intended to minimize harm to civilians, but really they recognize the fact that in war the objective is to kill the enemy. Now, if those rules govern anywhere in the world that a country believes a suspect might be found, that is an invitation to a sort of chaos. So we think it's extremely important. If the program is in fact more limited than it appears, the government should say so, so that we're not setting a dangerous precedent.
That was Jonathan Manis, legal fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project. Contact the ACLU by calling area code 202-457-0800 or visit their website at aclu.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.